nice to be back. I had a good time. Very good time. I love the desert. One of the most famous images in Zen and Buddhism generally, probably known to most of you, not all, is the full moon shimmering up in the sky and the finger pointing at the moon. I finally actually emailed to one of my Zen teacher groups saying, what's the oldest time? It's very old image, the finger pointing at the moon. It's an image of the wisdom seeker. And it's most often taken as an admonishment that when we use our finger to point to the moon, we mustn't confuse the finger with the moon. And that's the usual place where that image is about. Not only that there is a moon of truth, purity, of clarity, but that we need to look to find it and have some guidance of what are we going to do with our eyes. We're going to look. But that the finger pointing to the moon is not the moon. The moon is wisdom. Boy, it shone out over the desert. Shines out beautifully here too. Shines evenly on all with a great kind of purity. It can't be made of cheese then, right? You know, well, we have a man in the moon. The Japanese have a rabbit in the moon. So we have all these projections on it, but mostly it's a great symbol of a purity and an even-handedness. It shines evenly on all with a great quiet, clear quality that we can be aware of because of the darkness around. There's so little visible around, and there's the moon. Of course, now we have so much light that that impression is dimmed. But even so, there's not a lot to see. Things are quiet and dark, and there is this great shimmering light. And it's endlessly moving, to boot, moving across the heavens, waxing and waning, always there and always in motion, sort of still and clear and also endlessly changing. It's a wonderful reality in itself and a wonderful symbol. And the finger is very handy to point it out. So the finger stands for all our words, all our ideas, all our teachings, ideas in all our minds, ideas that come out of my mouth. It's all of that. They're all the finger pointing at the moon. But to make sure we don't get stuck on admiring the finger and forget that it's just a pointer. And so there are great pictures, Zenga, the Zen painting, ink, brush and ink paintings, particularly Japanese, with this really very simple image, and there is a very wonderful common image of a long-armed monkey dangling from a branch, and the moon shining overhead, and the monkey pointing at the moon. Monkeys filled with monkey mind. That the monkey mind that leaps like a nutcase around the jungle canopy, and then gets so distracted it forgets all about the moon and the finger, and says, "Oh," and starts picking nits out of its fur. Well, that's the monkey. So that pointing finger is just the messenger, right? Not the message. Just human efforts and ideas. Don't think of the finger as something real. It's just a temporary and changing and wavering and imperfect instrument. And the moon is real and unperturbed. And so the moon then stands for what is real and true. But All of that is by way of preamble, because I really want to praise the finger that points at the moon. This finger is our words, our minds. No, merely just something, not just a tool. Our words, our the language of our mind is our words. Our minds are wondrous things. They're also stupid things, but they're really wondrous things. And we all get all tied up in our minds and in our swarms of words and in our stupidity and in each other's stupidity. Was it breakfast today? Someone said that in a recent poll, 15% of the people polled, it was a political poll, said that they believe that because Barack Obama's middle name is Hussein, he's a Muslim. 15% of American adults who were polled. And so the mind is also very stupid. And so then we say, that's just... I want some moon. Give me some moon. Give me some wisdom. Something reliably wise. Not this...
Not this lunacy.
Exactly. I took the word out, so I think... they're wonderful puns, yes. Not this lunacy, that lunacy. So we need to really give some really good attention throughout our entire lives to this finger, to the waggling finger, and the finger that we get confused by and tied in knots about. If I want to praise the finger that points at the moon, it's not to take away the real important message, the first message of that image, that we do get so caught up in believing in what we think, that we're sure we're right. And then things don't come in. New information doesn't come in very well because we already have it covered. And so maybe I'm not like that. I have my mind is subtle and supple, and it takes new ideas in, and it likes new ideas, and yeah, and then it plays with them, and then it falls in love with them, and then it falls in hate with them, and yeah. So whatever kind of mind we have, we get in trouble with it. The kind of turgid mind that doesn't look around and open to new information, that's one kind of confused mind. And the mind that loves new ideas and gets caught up in them is another kind of confused mind. Of course, we all have both kinds. So then we fall in love with our minds and say, oh, this is who I am. And we clothe ourselves in our ideas about ourselves. That's believing in our words. We get clothed in our ideas of who we are. And then, you know, the winds of life come along and whip the clothes of our lives over our heads, and we can't see what we're doing, and we trip, and we don't know how it happened because we're so caught in our ideas. We all know that when we're so caught in our ideas, or my idea about who you are, perhaps, that I can't really see you and treat you even a little bit as you because I have an idea about who you are and then about how we'll relate. And so we do this. This is what we mean by delusion. This is when we see the finger and believe in it. Say, oh, this is, look at that. Well, actually, it's kind of crooked. And it's getting more crooked all the time. It's not getting clearer. The finger just keeps getting crooked. Maybe human wisdom is when we know our finger is crooked. It doesn't stop getting crooked, but we know that about it. So we forget that words are not what they represent. That's also the finger and the moon. The finger isn't the moon, it's the finger. The word moon, the word lunch will not fill your belly. In fact, it will more likely say, oh, you know, it's true, I'm hungry.
Lunch.
You know, there's the monkey in the jungle. Lunch, what do I want? Maybe I should go to Wildwood. You know, no, but it's going to be crowded. You know, 10 minutes later we come back, right? We believe in the word as the thing it represents, including ourselves. Or emotional words. Oh, we believe those. The words of blame and the words of shame, very hard not to believe in them, to let them be words. If you hear someone behind you say, you're a nincompoop, who doesn't take it personally? A, maybe they didn't mean you, and B, if they did, maybe they're wrong. Maybe they're right. Mm-hmm. All of those, but we take it as some kind of a cudgel, a real attack. We may not even agree with it, but it's a real attack. And we get all caught up. Or, oh no, not you. You're wise. I meant someone else. Fluff up a little bit. Right? All of that is this mistaking the finger for the moon. And so the story of the finger pointing at the moon and not wanting to confuse the finger and the moon is wise up to a point. But I really want to praise the finger and the body it comes out of. It is of great importance. It's not just a messenger. It's not just a tool. Without the body, there'd be no finger to point. Without the body, there'd be no finger attached to a hand to hold hands or to touch. And without the body and the finger, we would never know where to look. So the finger is essential. And it's a problem when, as wisdom seekers, the finger pointing at the moon and not mistaking the finger for the moon is really a great image of the wisdom seeker. Here we seek to have some wisdom in our lives to understand, and we take that story so to heart that we disrespect the finger and the body it comes attached to. The finger is where enlightenment happens. It doesn't happen up in some moon. Moon doesn't care. Moon is just out there being the moon. It's here. It's here that the connections happen. It's here that our ideas happen and that we point and we look and we connect. It's here that the words happen that guide us. One of my favorite of the koans is the one that says that Kuan Yin is the image of throughout the body, our hands and eyes. The traditional image of Kuan Yin as a great helper, one who reaches out to all beings, is with many, many, many hands. So there's a version with Avalokiteshvara and Kuan Yin are basically the same being. 6 arms, 8 arms, 1,000 hands and arms, each one of which has an eye in the palm. And the great arch of them all the way out like this. And in the koan, one says, well, where are the 1,000 hands and eyes of Kuan Yin? One says, actually, they're all over the body. And says, no, they're not just all over the body. Throughout your body are hands and eyes. There's nothing about you that is not the hands and eyes of the eyes of wisdom, of seeing, and the hands that reach out. Throughout the body are hands and eyes. That's our bodhisattva direction. So wisdom and compassion don't take place up on the moon. They take place here. In every cell. So Wisdom and compassion are the body pointing at the moon. They're here. Or they're this whole picture together, the finger and the moon. The only way that image really can nourish us is if the whole thing isn't a storyline about here's the finger and there's the moon and don't mistake one for the other, but the whole thing is you and the whole thing is me. You're the finger and you're the moon and you're the connection between them, the exchange, the interchange. Maybe I spent too much time out in the starry nights in the desert. You know, there's a if this is merely the finger and that's the moon, we tend to put down our words. And the words are, they're very dicey words. They're very difficult. They're sharp. And they're absolutely essential. And they are a great gift. So we don't want to say, oh, merely words. Words are the language of our minds. The language of understanding, the language of connection. When Ty and I were driving, when we had those long days of driving across Arizona, we listened to a couple of different books on tape. It was fun on the way out. We listened to Tony Hillerman, and there we were in the Four Corners, Lieutenant Lee Horn is roaring around the bend. But on the way back, we listened to a book called, by a guy named David Hickson, about a man who doesn't speak. War injury. And he's made a little life for himself. But it's a monologue. It's a first-person novel. The man is monologuing in his head to us. But he has almost no language. He owns a home. He has a very simple job. He's kept his life very, very retreated in something. Breaks it open just a little bit and things start to open up, and it's beautifully written. You see how he can just barely cope because his emotional life is a little bit easily triggered and hard to keep under control once things get going. It's a consequence of the injury too, many years ago. But for him to have constant stream of reasonably intelligent, thoughtful responses to what's going on in his world and have to just go on interacting with people as much or as little as he will without being able to use words, it was very moving. His world was very real and vivid and populated. There's a lot of furniture and activity, you know, and going on in his, a lot of thoughts and feelings going on, but his connection out was very, very thin. The words are absolutely so, so very important. So to have the ability to express inside yourself the wisdom and thoughts of your life is essential to making any sense of your life. He had enough there. I mean, there's a lot of changes in the store, so there's enough there to keep you going. But to be able to share some of that with others, even just through the simple language of our lives, we don't have to be talking philosophies, to share exchanges with people and to be able to tell someone what happened, not to have them misconstrue and see you differently because of it, is just so very, very important. Who we are. It's not just some tool. Who we are is this language we speak. Without it, there wouldn't be any wisdom seeking without language. And love would be so inarticulate. So the whole finger and the moon is you and is me. This body is the body of Buddha, not some other one. We don't want to go chasing off after a moon that's somewhere else. My little finger is down here, and the moon, wisdom or truth or goodness or love, is out there somewhere else. This very body is the body of Buddha, of awakening, of love, of sorrow, of caring, of awareness, of living and dying. Words are so rich. I learned last night that the first person I ever had a crush on died a few years ago. I was still hoping to go back and see him. I only met him once when I wasn't, what, maybe a cousin once removed. I was about 9, and he showed up. His name was Gordon McKibben. He was a young man in an army uniform who came once to visit us in Woods Hole. It was the first crush of my life, so you remember that one real vividly. I would just, you know, I could still feel how in love I was with Gordon McKibben. His hair was already turning white. It runs in the family. And I never saw him again. And I kind of, I hadn't thought about it for 30, 40 years. Somehow in the last couple of years, I realized I'd like to see him again and see where he was, you know, what was in his life. And then I discovered that he had died a few years ago. So all of that required language and words. So my whole world then and my world since has been in some way made up of. Well, it turns out he was a really nice guy. There is that. And throughout his life, he was a really, really good guy. But then I was genuinely sad. Now, was that false? Is that made up? Well, no. It was all, those are all kind of real feelings. Those are still fingers, right? But there's real feelings about a real person and a real connection that didn't get to continue and yet in some way did continue. So, you know, one more person to be sorry that Gordon died and that I'm glad that he had a really good life. This is a wonderful thing about being able to Google. I wouldn't have found this much out about him if I hadn't been able to Google him. This is, you know, we were talking about karma yesterday. This is karma. This is our karma. It's not just, oh, this bad thing happened to us or we did and then there's consequences. This is our world of karma, that something wonderful happened, well, when I was 9 years old, that had a little impact, huge, I mean, just a little impact on my life and a positive one. And then many years later, I get to think about it and think about him. And I remembered him, you know, all along. I don't know what he, you know, my image of him, maybe not too much like what he really looked like anymore. You know, it's been a long time. And then I have a response. And it's good to have that response of kind of a little bit of love and a little bit of sorrow for something. And that's karma carried forward. The fruits, in a sense, and we speak, karma is our volitional action, all of our human actions, and they have fruits or consequences. And so the consequence of that is something that sort of flowered last night for me, sitting at my computer, thinking about Gordon and the fact that he had died, and I won't get to see him again. I don't know if I would have anyway, but I might have, because it had finally occurred to me that I would like to do this. Something I can do, and I would like to do that. But the it's not a bad fruit. Karma is, this is all our actions, our intentions, the kind of person he was, the kind of person I was, that he became and I became, and then it has a little flowering and it moves on. And all it did was, you know, tenderize my heart one more little notch. That is karma as much as anything else. And so, yeah, you know, the finger pointing at the moon is a karmic finger. It's a finger that, you know, goes like this, and goes like this, you know. And then it says, oh, there's a tear, let me wipe it away. So this is the body and the finger are extremely important. You might say that in some sense, if we take the whole thing as ours and who we are, the moon is this ideal or universal. The moon shining evenly on all is a side that is universal and common and shared. And then the finger is this individual personal self. Well, they're not separate. The finger and the moon, the finger points to the moon and the moon points to the finger, and there they are together. They're one entity. The finger pointing at the moon pointing at the two together in the night. The moon does pull on us in a very literal way. Because for women, there's a menstrual cycle. It's a monthly cycle. For all of us, there's the tides. There's the way it moves plants growing. times of the month when, and it's not, you know, I used to think that was old wives' tales. Well, it's not. That in, I think it's in the waning of the moon, rooting happens better, and in the waxing of the moon, growth upward happens more strongly in plants. We are in a endless dialogue with the moon. We are not separate from the moon, nor it from us. This is a relationship we have here. So the finger and moon story is a warning. It says, yes, take these words and this body to remember that there's something larger than just what you can, than just stick your finger in your ear. There's something bigger you can do with your life. A larger way to understand things. But make sure that you don't mistake, not only mistaking the finger and thinking it's the big deal, but don't think that just some moon outside you, pure and cold, is the big deal and you're only some wee sleeky beastie down here. It's all one. So when Uchiyama Roshi, you know, talks about the universal self, and maybe that's the moon shining evenly on all, and a personal self is this one here with the finger, but they're not separate beings. We are, at the same time, one individual person and part of a universal whole. Something very large. We are the moon and the finger in connection. And one of the traditional ways that Buddhism speaks in terms of emptiness, saying, finger is empty of being something other than a finger. Don't mistake it for somehow something more than that. But Zen also says, don't get caught by emptiness. Don't think, oh, things are empty. And, oh, there's nothing here. Oh, there's nothing here. That's not it either. The body is the body of life happening. Take good care of it. Take it out to play. Take it out to meet with another body. Give it, care for it, and nurture it as the body of life and awakening, and to be cared for as that, individually and collectively. It's when we mistake thinking it's just a thing, just a finger, just words, that we can also treat our earth as just things and not take good care of it. So the same impulse of taking care of this tender body is this very same impulse of taking care of this tender earth and that tender body, because they're not separate bodies. So if we only stay in a world where we say, oh, this is my finger, and I don't need to think past that, here I am, this nice body, and we don't think in terms of this large world of finger and moon and interaction, then we lose this awareness of this body and this body and this body are all together and must all be cared for together. The finger and the moon, the personal and the universe are one self, and you can't really take good care of one without taking good care of the other. So to take good care of this one is not to set it apart. Oh, I'll just take care of me. It's to take care of the same impulse as the same impulse of taking care of each other and of our earth, of paying attention to it. We like to. It's good to pay attention to ourselves and to what's going on. And what's going on is what's going on around us and in the sky and on the earth. I think that was one of the wonderful things about the desert, is that maybe there aren't so many different things going on that you can't pay attention to them. And it's like the world slows down, and the visual world slows down enough that I can see it. And maybe that's why I love the desert so much. I can see this plant, and then I can see this plant. And I can see the lizards running around between them. And you can hear each bird call and each the wings of the birds. So I need a slow world in order to be able to really see it very clearly. But then it reminds me that in fact here too, where it's so much more complicated with so many more trees and leaves and people, that it's the same world of house, tree, person, rock, sky to pay a kind of a loving attention to. Then the finger and the moon are really in real communication, and it's one world. You're the finger and you're the moon, and that's the meaning of that story as far as I'm concerned. This very land is the lotus land of liberty. That's Hakuintpo. This very land is the lotus land of liberty. This very body is the Buddha. Moon and all, ordinary, dumb, enlightened, confused, and heartful. Take good care of yourselves, of each other, and of the earth. It's all one care. So the more, any time we learn something of caring for ourselves or caring for another, it's that same caring that we can then feel to extend into those other realms. It's only one. I had a really good time in the desert. And it was, the Joshua tree was flowering as it hasn't, and I went in and was talking to the rangers after a couple of days there. They said it's been decades since they've had that much flowering there. That it was just the perfect flowering season. And Ty said, well, but it hasn't rained and so dry. And they said, it doesn't matter. That's our idea. But they said that Joshua tree, every desert is different. And Joshua tree is its own particular wonderful bridging of different deserts. It has to rain in November for the seeds to start to germinate. And then it has to rain in February to move them along. And it doesn't matter if it rains in December, January, March, or April for those for the flowering season. Amazing. So it's not how wet was the winter. It was, did it rain in November? And did it rain in February? Boy, it's a pretty fragile world out there. So there were carpets of flowers in places, and then there were just dozens of different kinds of flowers flowering. Big ones and little ones and tiny ones and purple and red and orange and yellow and white and blue and I think that's why there were woodpeckers and all kinds of strange creatures. And the Mojave, a very strange caterpillar, 3 inches long and fat, eating these little tiny desert plants. It had a unicorn and it had a horn on its head. And I saw 3 of them out in the Mojave. So probably some big moth. I don't have my insect book, it's packed, so I couldn't look it up.